There's been a lot of discussion in light of the shooting in Tucson over the weekend about whether or not the accused shooter, Jared Loughner, will use the insanity defense when he goes to court.
When you see that picture, his mugshots staring
disturbing.
Out of it. Yeah, I mean,
it's
all by
disturbing.
Itself, that would
the
be...
The smile.
Yeah, Exhibit A, but
that's
not
pure
how
pure speculation
exactly.
At this point. We have absolutely no idea whether that is going to be used for his defense or whether he has a psychological evaluation or any of that. We did have a discussion some time ago on The Takeaway about the insanity defense and its place in the courtroom in reference to the shooting in Fort Hood with Major Nidal Malik Hassan. And we want to step away from details about cases about which we don't really have details, and we just want to examine again the idea of the insanity defense and the place that it has in justice. Luckily, we have an expert on the subject with us, David Brook, a law professor at Washington and Lee School and capital defense attorney. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
I mean, obviously, there's not much we know about these two particular cases in which the insanity defense has been mentioned. But I wanted to talk about the insanity defense and how it has been, in the United States at least, altered by politics. I was looking up the history of the insanity defense, and I found that one of the very first times in which somebody was acquitted because of insanity, the verdict was overturned by Queen Victoria. This is in 1843. And it seems to me that politics has always played a role in the idea of mental health when we're trying capital crimes. Would you agree with that?
Oh, well, that's true. The insanity defense has been used or attempted in high-profile crimes, and there tends to be a very strong bias against it, which especially surfaces in high-profile cases where there's an idea that the insanity defense is just a way of that a guilty criminal or a killer beats the rap.
Well, you know, certainly as the insanity defense has evolved over the years, it's to a certain extent reflected our ideas about what insanity is, because at first, for hundreds of years, the test was whether or not somebody knew something was right or wrong. But then psychiatrists started asking, even if they knew it was right or wrong, could they have stopped themselves from doing it, right?
Well, that's right. The test hundreds of years ago, the medieval standard was something called the wild beast test, which really asked whether the accused was so mentally ill that he had no more reasoning capacity than a wild animal. And I heard an echo of that in the coverage the other day when Wolf Blitzer and the correspondent on CNN were saying, well, he doesn't look so crazy to us. He answered the judge's questions as if someone who was psychotic or seriously mentally ill would be sort of ranting and raving, and if they weren't, then you knew that there was nothing wrong with them. So this is a bias which, lives on to the current day, although it certainly doesn't reflect what we know about mental illness today.
Well, certainly, whether or not Jared Loughner and his attorney choose any kind of insanity plea, whether in the case or in sentencing, is going to be affected by what happened with John Hinckley and the attempted assassination of Reagan. Because John Hinckley was ruled not guilty by virtue because of insanity, that changed the law in all 50 states.
Well, it didn't change it everywhere, but it changed it in under federal law, and generally, you're right, did lead to a nationwide reaction. The insanity defense was fairly narrow and quite difficult to establish even at the time of the Hinckley case, but Congress narrowed the insanity defense still further in the wake of Hinckley. Specifically, at the time of the Hinckley case, if a defendant knew that what he did was wrong, but he was so mentally ill that he couldn't help himself, couldn't keep himself from doing it, that was a valid insanity defense. And Congress changed that and said that even if he couldn't have prevented himself from committing the crime because of mental illness, he's still guilty. The only test of insanity now is that you have to have been so mentally ill that you actually didn't know that what you did was wrong at all,
and even,
which is very, very demanding standard.
And even that test sort of goes against some of our intuition. And the Hinckley case, of course, complicated by the fact that the target was a president. A more contemporary example is the Andrea Yates case, where she killed her 5 kids. And, of course, you know, the entire nation was ruling on her mental state during the entire trial. How did that play out in the end?
Well, she was retried. The Texas courts ruled that she didn't get a fair trial the first time, and she had to be retried. And at the retrial, the jury did find her insane. The evidence that was based on was that she was so incapacitated by psychotic delusions that had to do with severe depression that she actually thought that drowning her children was what she had to do, that it was not only not wrong, but that it was her moral duty. This was somebody for whom right and wrong were completely turned around 180 degrees by severe psychotic mental illness. And the jury recognized that or accepted that and found her not guilty by reason of insanity.
David Brook, I want to ask you, because this is another thing that we're hearing not just on news coverage of the Jared Loftner shooting, but also in people's questions and comments on forums. People keep saying, I don't think he can use the insanity defense because there appears to be so much evidence that it was planned and premeditated and carefully planned. Was premeditation or planning for a criminal event or a violent act, does that have any effect on whether someone can plead guilty by virtue of insanity?
It could, but that really is a non sequitur. It doesn't follow because, let's say, for example, and I have no idea whether this is true in the Loftner case, but let's say that a person commits a crime under the grip of a psychotic delusion he's being—he's the target of a plot by space aliens the sort of delusion that afflicts people with schizophrenia, paranoid type, for example, which is a very severe mental illness. Someone like that could be planning and planning and planning for months and years. The problem isn't whether or not there's planning. The problem is the quality of the thinking that goes into it. And if the crime is the product of a psychotic delusion, then all the planning in the world doesn't make him legally sane.
Are juries prepared, David Brook, lastly, to rule on these kind of things? Not just whether somebody did the crime, but whether they were in the state of their health? Mental health?
Well, to begin with, there's tremendous bias against the insanity defense. People think that that it's something that's used commonly. In fact, it's almost never attempted and is successful very rarely in the few cases that it is attempted. One of the reasons it's very hard to succeed in an insanity defense is that
unfortunately, David, we'll have to leave it there. That's David Brook, a law professor at Washington and Lee School, capital defense attorney. Interesting discussion. Thank you so much.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.